Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. The time is 1:31 in the afternoon. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself as chair, Senator Holland. Senator Schauer is going to be excused for the day. We do have a quorum to conduct business, though. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Talia, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Our first order of business today is a consideration of governor's appointees. We do have four appointees on the calendar today. If anyone in the public has information that you think the members should have about any of these appointees, please email them to, and here's going to be an email address. So it's SJUD, that's, see if I remember, the Sierra Juliet Uniform Delta, at akleg.gov, which stands for Senate Judiciary at akleg.gov. So SJUD at akleg.gov. All right, so our four appointees today will be Jedediah Cox to the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Jason Wilson, State Board of Parole, Jeff Brown, Alaska Police Standards Council, and Michael Craig, Alaska Police Standards Council. And we have them joining. I see Jedediah Cox, you're queued up. And if you would, with people joined electronically, we ask that you state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record, and then proceed with introducing yourself to the committee.
Yes, thank you. My name is Jed Cox of Big Lake, Alaska.
Wait one moment, because we might have to turn you up just a little bit.
Okay, so, thank you, yeah.
Yeah, just give us like a count to 10, if you would.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Now, that was not a test.
That was not a test. I thought you were trying to get a volume meter on me.
So, Mr. Cox, please state your name, affiliation, and location for the record, and introduce yourself to the committee. We're hearing you very well right now.
Okay, excellent. So, yes, again, Jed Cox of Big Lake, Alaska. And I am before you today for the Alaska Bar Association Board of Governors as the public member.
All right. Did you have an introductory statement to read or anything?
Yes, sir. So, thank you, of course, Senate Judiciary Committee. I have been honored to serve one term on the Alaska Bar Association Board of Governors as one of the three public members, and I would be honored to do so again to serve the people of Alaska. During my first term on the board as a public member, we bought our building over on K Street here in Anchorage, which has brought in more funding, so we've been able to make improvements, improving the work environment for our employees and renters. We've reviewed the UBE scores, the Unified Bar Exam scores, reviewing the cutoff scores there. We, of course, adapted to COVID like everybody else in the state, which has been interesting. Continued providing discipline, exams, and the continued ed units for the Bar Association. We've replaced our former executive after her retirement, Deborah Reagan, and are happy to have Danielle Bailey with us now. We've kept dues at the same rate for my 3 years and quite a few years before that. And I am currently on the building subcommittee. I've also assisted with our most recent evaluation of our executive and bar counsel, Phil Shanahan. And also, we have hired a new bar counsel, Mr. Phil Shanahan. So, thank you for your time and consideration, and of course, I'm available for questions.
All right. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cox, we had the board extension for the Board of Governors come through this committee last year, and there was a little bit of contentiousness over continuing ed questions and whether that should be raised and if we needed to specify something in particular. I believe it was, if I remember right, it was something over ethics training. And I was just curious to hear your opinion on some of that.
Yeah, so as far as I understand it, this is a common request that comes up from the legislature, and I believe we are planning to add another 3 continuing ed units for the ethics proportion. This, and in regards to in response to the sunset conferences that were held last year. Last year.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Jed, for your service. Do you remember how that compared to other states? Because I think part of what we were interested in seeing was it being closer to what other states require. Does that bring you up to kind of the national standard?
That would, yeah. That's what we are a little bit less than the national standard, but not. We are quite close, though. I believe that addition would bring us up to what the rest of the Northwest is doing. You know, a lot of times we refer to the Northwest to get a comparative of where we would like to be in relation to our most similar neighbors in America.
Thank you.
All right. With no other questions, Mr. Cox, thank you for appearing before us today. At this point, we're going to move on to the next appointee up, which would be Jason Wilson, State Board of Parole. And we're doing some magic behind the screen there. Let's see. A brief at ease. I was curious about that. Wilson, this is not about you. That brief at ease was just a procedural thing. But so I didn't hear you laughing, so be aware that your mic might be muted. But once again, if you would please state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record, and then introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
That's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Jason Wilson. I'm in Juneau, and I'm here for the parole board reappointment. Mr. Chairman, did you want me to go ahead and kind of keep going?
Please proceed.
Thanks, sir. So, just a brief introduction of myself, for everyone. My name is Jason Wilson. I am Clinkett. I am, Eagle Killer Whale. My Clinkett name is Kitchka East, which means father of the winged drum. I'm born and raised in Juneau. I'm 55 years old. I have 4, happily married, and have 4 daughters, 3 that have left the nest, so to speak, and have moved on and doing very well in life. I have a 8-year-old daughter who is the energy of my day every single day, and I cherish that. I get a lot of grief from my friends, I'll just share it, just because my 3 older were older. Obviously, I was looking at being done, but we decided to have one more, and I'm glad we did. Just a little bit of my background. I've worked for Clinkett Haida Central Council for roughly 18 years in different capacities. My current capacity is I'm the BPSO manager, in charge of Southeast Alaska. I've been a head coach at the high school level. I did 10 years as the head swim coach. I was an assistant coach for softball. And currently I am an assistant head coach with the girls, varsity basketball. I've been there in that capacity for about 4 years now. I've also worked, I did 8 years as a youth counselor at the Dunst Youth Center. Enjoyed my time there working with youth. This is, looking at my second term as on the parole board. And, this was a huge learning, being exposed to the parole board. As I'll be honest, when I was appointed the first time, I knew very little about the parole board. And now I don't, by no means am I an expert, but at least I have an understanding of what we're trying to achieve. And I also understand a little bit more on, what my contributions might be to that board. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. A review of your employment history. It looks like you spent a lot of time as a youth counselor at detention facilities and family caseworkers, welfare coordinators, justice specialists. And I appreciate being a new person over here in the Senate. You know, I got last year under my belt, and I kind of feel a little better this year to do it. I also appreciate, you know, you're willing to come back and serve again with maybe not having to climb that learning curve so quickly. You spent a lot of time just learning the rules. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, Mr. Wilson, I have an 8-year-old daughter of my own, so I definitely appreciate the energy comment. I can definitely sympathize. I was looking over your employment history, your same as our chair, and you've got quite an interesting resume, and I'm just curious how you view your time with the Clint Kent and Haida Council and working with the VPSOs and how that affects your views and your decisions on the parole board.
Representative Myers, through the chair, a very good question. And I think it, when you look at trying to make the best decision as possible, when you're viewing somebody, your history and your background of everything comes into play. My time with VPSOs, I have, I'll be honest, a better understanding of what it's like in the villages, a better understanding of what our officers do because I'm in communications with them constantly. But that also puts me in touch with what some of the needs are in our community. Working in the different capacities that Clint and Haida, both in family youth services, we get to see some of the struggles that our people face. And you have to come to each hearing that we do with somebody coming before the parole board open-minded and really with the understanding that people weren't made to make these poor decisions. There's different factors that come into making these poor decisions and poor choices that they make. And so having the understanding of what it looks like in the different areas kind of helps with that understanding. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense to you. It did in my head. So.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none. Oh, sorry, Senator Hughes.
Well, first, I have a comment. Is I like. I think you have got the best back screen behind you of anyone we've had before us. It's very nice. And I was just wondering on the Board of Parole, correct? That's how it works when you vote. Can you just give us quickly how many people are on that board? And the chair, I believe, is Edie Grunwald. And do all of you agree in your experience so far on the board? Or is there
there are many split decisions.
Split decisions, that kind of thing?
Thank you, Representative Hughes, through the chair. Another good question. And I guess, first of all, thank you for your comments on my background. I love the different backgrounds that our organization has provided us during the pandemic. You know, there's five board members. Edie Grunwald is our chairman. Sarah Pazenti is our vice chair. The process that we go through in voting is more of a discussion as well as a vote. And I don't know that we're always unanimous in coming to a decision. However, I have yet to really see us become split where we're so far off on a person in a direction that we want to go. Usually we'll have one person who's kind of, you know, I really kind of feel strongly because of this, and this. I'm a yay or I'm a nay, so to speak. I think what you find with this board, which is really awesome to me, is looking at being creative. You know, it's not an easy decision to look at someone and say, you know, we're just going to go ahead and parole somebody and let them out. That is not that simple. There's a lot of factors that come into play, but the decisions aren't always black and white either. And sometimes you have to be a little bit creative of what you're trying to achieve. Our goal, yes, we want them to be out and be productive citizens in society. That might take a different route, though. And sometimes, you know, we look at what's the probation officer suggesting as far as release. And that might be something, and then we have our parole board has the experience and the background of past probation officers. Our vice chair is an ex-probation officer. And then Steve Meyer, who's also a board member, is ex-probation officer. So we have some serious knowledge and background of, well, what if we did this? What if we looked at EM? What if we looked at the halfway house instead of this? What if we looked at transitional housing instead of this? That way we're able to get what we want, but it might just be a different road. And I think that's what the strength of this body is, and this board really is about. How do we figure out to do the best for getting somebody out? Hopefully that answered the question, man.
That was actually a wonderful explanation, very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for that insight. With no other questions from the committee, thanks again, Mr. Wilson. Now we will move on to Jeff Brown. So Jeff Brown is the first of two appointees to the Alaska Police Standards Council. And we're getting you queued up for a second, Mr. Brown. If you maybe give us a, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I could hear you. If I try to turn on my camera, I will tank my bandwidth. I've already dropped four times for you guys, so I'm afraid to do that. I may lose you.
That's all right. We get that a lot. So once again, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record. Introduce yourself and then begin any presentation you may want to offer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Brown. I've been appointed to the Alaska Police Standards Council, and I'm currently in Utqiagvik, Alaska. Began my law enforcement career over 20 years ago in Virginia and moved to Alaska in 2006, where I've served in various capacities with the North Slope Borough Police Department and the Alaska Department of Public Safety's Office of Professional Standards. I currently reside here in Utqiagvik, serving as the Chief of Police for the North Slope Borough Police Department. My varied experience in public safety gives me a unique and well-rounded perspective on law enforcement that makes me well-suited for carrying out the council's mission. I want to thank you for your consideration and support, and I'm available to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions from the committee? I'm afraid you may have wowed us, Mr. Brown. So with no questions from the committee, I'll just say we haven't had a chance to look over your resume. It looks pretty impressive. And what we will do at this time is move on to the other Alaska Police Standards Council appointee, Michael Craig. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just don't want you to feel you were not shorted because we couldn't see your face. Thank you for appearing before us today. Next up is Michael Craig. And Mr. Craig, if you can hear me, please state your name, affiliation, and location for the record, then introduce yourself to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Craig, as you have seen and said. I am in Anchorage. The affiliation will be a reappointment to the Alaska Police Standards Council as one of the public members for the larger cities. There's two different versions of the public member position. Mine is in the larger city capacity. I have been on the Alaska Police Standards. I filled the remainder of the appointment for Ron Burton. So from 2017, I think, to 2018, I then filled the four-year term from that point. And just been really a wonderful experience for me, learning and understanding and contributing to that group. So when the opportunity came up to run for another term, I just absolutely did with no hesitation. I have been in Alaska since 1963. My family came here, as many do, I think, with the military, and grew up in Glen Allen, was raised primarily there, graduated from high school there. We did go for a couple of years to Valdez in the early 70s. My dad was a weather service with the Weather Service, and he set up the very first weather station before the pipeline was built. But then once all the pipes started to get moved in, he thought, I'm not going to raise my family in this boomtown kind of environment. So we went back to Glen Allen, and that's, you know, where I also, many of my family still lives. My wife's family still lives, that sort of thing. So we get back there quite a bit. I have been working with on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1983. The bulk of that time is in different capacities within security. The last 20 years with Alyeska, in a corporate security capacity. So lots of connection with law enforcement, military through drills and exercises and meetings and a whole host of things. I did get transitioned out of security 6 years ago into the business practices office. So my current role for the last 6 years has been as employee concerns coordinator. And in that capacity, I do very similar kind of work as what the Alaska Police Standards Council does in regards to listening to and reviewing situations and cases and investigation that involve activities that, you know, people have been involved in or conflict that, you know, people have been involved in, and then make a determination from an independent objective perspective on, you know, what those determinations, you know, might be. For that position within Alyeska, I have a professional certified investigator license. I also have a fair amount of experience in like technical writing, so reviewing procedures translated really well into the reviewing of regulations and stuff that we have to do as part of the council. My experience on the council has been tremendous, as I said. Even though 8 of the 12 positions are law enforcement, many of those are chiefs, there is no pressure to vote, if you will, in lockstep with, you know, whatever the law enforcement perspective is. As a public member, you know, what I bring to the table is that, you know, that view, that prism around what was the public, what would they consider, you know, to be, you know, fair and equitable in these situations. And in all the years I've been on it, I have not felt anyone, you know, from law enforcement look at me like, you know, how could you possibly, you know, vote that way? So I've been really appreciative of the balance that committee or that council has held. And it gives you confidence then to be able to speak up in any scenario about any of the cases or the situations that we're reviewing and be able to present or ask questions that you see as pertinent. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Are there any questions from the committee? Once again, looks like I guess we're afraid to ask cops questions. Or at least
I do not have any law enforcement experience. Yeah, it's all been in the growth of my position. So.
Cops are cop-like people. But
I get you.
All right, Mr. Craig. Thank you so much for appearing before the committee. Did you have anything else?
No, thank you very much.
All right, so at this time, I'm going to open up public testimony for these four positions. Oh, wait, a brief at ease. If anyone's listening in or in the room, we're going to take public testimony on Jedediah Cox with the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Jason Wilson, an appointee to the State Board of Parole, Jeff Brown, an appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, and Michael Craig, an appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council. So public testimony is now open on those four members. Public testimony is now open. I'll look around the rooms. Anyone in the room care to provide public testimony? Seeing no one, I'll look online, and I had taken a look through there before. It looks like, once again, there is no one waiting online. At this time, I will close public testimony on the four members. Public testimony is now closed. Is there any objection on the committee to sending these four appointees to the full Senate for consideration? Seeing no objection, Senator Hughes, would you care to make a motion?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair. I move that the record reflect that in accordance with AS 39.50-080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends appointments be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. Jebediah Cox, Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. Jason Wilson, Board of Parole. Jeff Brown, Alaska Police Standards Council. Michael Craig, Alaska Police Standards Council.
Hearing no objection, the motion passes, and I'll just state that by signing the reports regarding appointments to boards and commissions in no way reflects individual members' approval or disapproval of the appointees. The nominations are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejection. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease to sign some paperwork. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Next up on the calendar is, next up on the agenda, is Senate Bill 187 relating to sex crimes. Senate Bill 187 is back before the committee. It is the governor's bill. This is the first hearing on Senate Bill 187. My intent is to get an introduction of the bill today, then take member questions on Friday. Casey Schroeder and John Skidmore, it looks like they're coming up to the presenter's table. If y'all would get comfortable, please state your name and affiliation for the record and provide us with an overview on Senate Bill 187.
Good afternoon. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the Alaska Department of Law. I've been a prosecutor here in Alaska for over 24 years now. It's nice to be back in front of the committee and see so many of you in person again. It's a change of where we've been from the last several years, and it's a nice change. We're here today to discuss, and I'm sorry, at the table with me is Casey Schroeder, who's our legislative specialist. She is the person who does drafting and will be here to present the sectional for us after I do an overview of all of the highlights of the bill. We're here today, as you indicated, to discuss SB 187. And the idea behind 187 is to really try and make some small, focused changes to our laws in the state of Alaska as they address sex offenses. But even though they are small, they are very important changes. We're going to talk about harassment, creating a new crime or a new elevation in the crime of harassment to address some areas in which there are gaps in the laws currently. We're going to talk about making some amendments to the sex offender registration. We're going to talk about teaching certificates and what type of crimes would the legislature overall deem appropriate to say that person shouldn't be teaching our children. We're also going to talk a little bit, about the authorization that folks that work for the Department of Corrections have in order to file charges when they come across crimes in their day-to-day work. And then last but not least, I'll probably also touch on the idea of referring sexual conduct between two very young children under the age of 13 and when that should be referred to a multidisciplinary team to determine whether or not there are any issues or concerns with the type of conduct that occurred there, because our criminal justice system isn't designed or set up to address those issues. If I can, let me start with harassment. Currently in our laws in the state of Alaska, it may surprise you all and certainly may surprise some of the folks that are listening in that it is not a crime to simply walk up to another person and grab them in the crotch or the genitals. That is not a crime in the state of Alaska, unless that conduct was done with the intent to annoy or harass. There was actually a case decided by the Alaska Court of Appeals back in 2011. It was called Townsend. And in that case, it was about a gentleman that was here in a bar downtown Juneau. Enjoying an evening out, someone walked up to him, grabbed him in the crotch, person he did not know, did not want that conduct to occur, and it was a conduct that we attempted to prosecute. And the Court of Appeals said that we could not prosecute that conduct as a sexual assault because it did not qualify under our statutes as the type of force or threat of force that's needed in those circumstances. We do have the crime of harassment on our books, but currently that crime requires that a prosecution prove the intent to harass, to annoy that individual by that conduct. And that concept of having to prove that it's done for the purpose of annoying somebody else really doesn't make sense, because what that does is it leaves the conduct subject to a person saying, oh, I didn't do it for the intent to annoy them. I did it with the intent for sexual gratification. I did it with some other intent. And so long as that's the case, then that conduct is not a crime. This concept was reinforced just in 2021, again, by the Alaska Court of Appeals in a case called Dorsey. And in that case, what they said is that in order for the state to prove a case or to bring those charges, they must not only prove that the victim was not willing, but also that the victim was coerced by the use of force or the threat of force. And so what this bill does, what 187 does, is it takes the conduct of touching someone directly or through clothing in the genitals, butt, or female breast. When that conduct is unwanted, and the person has engaged in that conduct intentionally, recklessly to the fact that it was unwanted, that then would be a Class C felony. So it essentially closes that loophole that currently exists in our laws. That's the type of thing that we have heard from victims over the years in cases that we unfortunately had to decline because we did not think that it met the elements as described in current Alaska law. It addresses that issue of surprise, as I've just described to you from the Townsend case. It also addresses those cases in which you have a victim who has somebody contact them in that way and they immediately freeze. They're in utter shock that this person would have done that to them. Imagine having somebody walk up to you in Fred Meyer or in a grocery store or another store, in the bars, as occurred in Townsend. Or imagine the situation in which there is this conduct that occurs and you are shocked or afraid about what has happened. And if there is no coercion through force or the threat of force, those are not cases that we can prosecute. I can tell you that I myself have had to talk to victims, young victims, ages 18, 19, 20, who've been in those situations, who didn't know what to do, and they just froze. And I have the unfortunate, I won't call it pleasure because it's not a pleasure, I have the unfortunate circumstance to describe to them, I'm sorry, I know what happened to you feels like a violation of your person. I know what you're describing to me is not something that you wanted. I know that you feel humiliated. I know that you're upset. But I, as a prosecutor, cannot do anything because it is not a crime. I have two young daughters. One's a junior in high school. One just started college. I would be furious if that sort of conduct happened to one of my daughters and there couldn't be a prosecution for it. So that's harassment. The second thing I wanted to talk about is sex offender registration. We want to make some minor tweaks. There are certain crimes right now in our laws that don't require registration as a sex offender that probably should. And we make a few minor changes to require registration in those instances. I'll give you one quick example. It's sending an explicit image of a minor to another person. This is a crime where you take an electronic photo and with the intent to annoy or humiliate the victim, you send it to somebody else. That's a Class B misdemeanor when you send it to somebody else. But when you post it on a website, that becomes a Class A misdemeanor. Posting on the website, though, with the intent to annoy or humiliate, now starts to get to the level also, however, of being a sex offender. You are taking a photo that is taken of this person that is of their genitals, anus, or female breast that they did not want to be posted in that way and put online for any and everyone to see, for it to be resent and shared over and over and over again. And there is no legitimate way in our world today, in our society, to stop or eliminate the presence of that photo in that public space. In those circumstances, that's an example of where this bill says that person should have to register. There are other examples, and I can go through other details if that's something that you all want. But for purposes of time, I'm going to move on to the next area that I wanted to highlight about sex offender registration, and that's providing additional information to the Department of Public Safety. Currently, when you're required to register as a sex offender, you fill out a form. They ask you to supply a substantial amount of information. One of the things that they ask you to supply is your passport number, any intention to travel out of the country or away from your residence. But an individual is not required to provide that information. If you're on the federal registry, if you're on a registry in most other states, that information is required. Why? Well, it's not uncommon for individuals to take a vacation that is expressly for the purposes of engaging in sexual conduct with minors or other people that we would say is inappropriate. Knowing when that person's going to be traveling, helping us to know where they're going, what they're likely to be engaged in, is something that's helpful to those law enforcement agencies to be able to track the individuals. The other type of information that's required is a full name, a mailing and physical address, a school if you're at that school, what your phone number is, your social security number, citizenship, your employer, as well as your job title, temporary lodging that you might be having, a professional license that you hold, and a palm print. These are all things that are done to just help us bring us further into alignment with what is required in the federal system and other states. It's information that's helpful to law enforcement, and these are changes that are long overdue for us to be making. The next area that I wanted to highlight is teaching certificates. Currently in the state of Alaska, if you are convicted of certain types of sex offenses, a sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor, enticing a minor, indecent exposure, unlawful exploitation of minors, those all require a revocation of a teaching certificate for a lifetime. That's under Alaska Statute 1420.030, subsection B. What is not included in there is the possession of child pornography or the distribution of child pornography. So when I describe this to my wife, you talk about we send our kids to school, we entrust them with those adults to teach them and to be around them, quite frankly, for as many hours of the day as we are, and sometimes even more. Those individuals that we send our children to be with, we want to make sure that those are the individuals that we're confident should be around our children and should be teaching them. And if you have an individual who has been convicted of possession of child pornography or of distributing it, that's probably the type of conduct that I think most citizens would say, that's not really the person that I wanted my child to be spending time around. It's a common sense change that as we looked at these things in the administration, the Department of Education brought this up to us and suggested that this was a change appropriate for our laws. So while I in the criminal division don't generally deal with those situations, I certainly would agree this makes common sense approach and is something that's also found in SB 187 for your all's consideration. The next area that I wanted to touch on is the ability for employees in the Department of Corrections to take appropriate actions, that is to be able to charge individuals when they come across criminal conduct. Let me give you one specific example. In our state, there is a crime where if you are on conditions of probation for a sex offense and you violate those conditions, it can actually be a new crime to violate those conditions. In addition to being a violation of your conditions of probation, it can be a new crime. Well, when that probation officer finds that circumstance occurring, they shouldn't have to then also call law enforcement to come and try and investigate that. They've seen everything they need to know. They ought to be able to charge that as a crime when they come across that. Another example is if you have an individual that's out on conditions of release, pretrial, and that individual has unlawful contact, with a victim of a domestic violence case, a victim of a sexual assault case, the defendant's told, you're not supposed to be in contact with this victim. And when the pretrial services officer, who is told by the court, you're to monitor this person, you're to make sure they're not doing anything improper, when they come across that type of crime, they also ought to be able to charge that type of conduct. Those are the examples of the type of conduct that we're trying to get to and allow Department of Corrections employees to be able to address directly. The last thing that I'll touch on that this bill does is also deals with situations in which you have two young individuals under the age of 13 who engage in some sort of sexual conduct with one another. Currently, we would never charge them with a crime. It would not be a sexual assault. It would not be a sexual abuse. That's not something that my department or my division would deal with. In the Division of Juvenile Justice, they sometimes can bring charges against juveniles in that juvenile system. But even for them, when the offender is under the age of 13, they often will not attempt to adjudicate somebody of that age with having committed a crime. No one's suggesting that they should adjudicate them either. Rather, what this bill does is it says when that conduct is found by law enforcement or by DJJ, that they ought to make a referral to an entity that's already set up in our state. It's a multidisciplinary team that's meant to address children that are involved in concerning sexual conduct. They have the ability to evaluate that situation, and then they have the ability to refer or make recommendations for someone to get appropriate treatment. We're not suggesting that these children should be treated as criminals, but if they are displaying conduct that would be inappropriate for someone of that age, then they certainly ought to be seeking counseling or be given the opportunity to get counseling to try to address those problems before they grow up. And then they do become someone that I or the folks that work for me have to deal with because now they are committing sexual offenses. In the state of Alaska, we have the unfortunate designation of leading the nation in those types of sex crimes per capita. We ought to be doing what we can, not only when they commit those crimes, but trying to think more proactively and taking those preventative measures when they are younger to try to intervene, to intercede, and stop it from becoming a greater problem later on. That's in sum and substance the highlights that I would provide for you in 187. Unless there are questions, I would turn this over to Ms. Schroeder to give you all a sectional for the bill.
Are there any questions from the committee at this time? All right. No questions this time. Ms. Schroeder, please put yourself on the record and begin the sectional analysis.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. So Section 1 is a conforming change to the harassment statute that Mr. Skidmore referenced. And the substantive change is on page 2, line 12, and we're just incorporating that new harassment statute into the crime of stalking. And in essence, what this would mean is if somebody had been previously convicted of this type of harassment and then stalked the same victim, that crime would be elevated to a felony. Section 2 is the harassment in the first degree, which is the harassment crime that Mr. Skidmore outlined, where somebody is guilty if they intentionally subject another person to offensive physical contact by touching directly or through clothing the other person's genitals, buttocks, or female breast. And as he mentioned, this would be a Class C felony. Section 3 is a conforming change to the new harassment statute. We're in essence just renaming harassment in the first degree to harassment in the second degree. Section 4 is also a renaming. We're renaming current harassment in the second degree to harassment in the third degree. And while it looks like there's a lot going on in that section, we are only making one other substantive change, and that is on line 20, page 3, line 20, and page 3, line 7. We are changing the mental state from the intent to harass or annoy. We're changing it to knowingly, and this is a lower and broader mental state. And it's for those two subsections only. Section 5 begins the requirement of additional information that Mr. Skidmore mentioned for sex offenders. And you can see it there on page 4. It lists out all the additional information that a sex offender or child kidnapper would have to provide to the Department of Public Safety: social security number, passport information, citizenship information, job, child, et cetera. The other change that is made in this section is on page 5, and it's on line 14, where we are allowing any peace officer, in addition to somebody from the Department of Corrections or somebody from the Department of Public Safety, we're also allowing any peace officer to take the sex offender or child kidnapper's fingerprints. Section 6 is basically a conforming change. We are just making clear that the people who are required to register for 15 years and for life, which are the only two categories that Alaska has, are required to provide the information that I listed in Section 5. Section 7 gets into the travel plans aspect of the bill. So a sex offender or child kidnapper would need to notify the Department of Public Safety if they have travel plans, and the notice varies depending on where they're going. So for example, if they're going out of state, they would need to give the department 7 days notice. If they're they're planning international travel, they would have to give the department 21 days notice. And if they are going to be away from the address that they've already provided to the department for 7 days or more, say they're on a long work trip, they would have to notify the department of that as well. Section 8, page 7, is where the substantive change in Section 8 is. And in essence, that makes clear that the tolling period, so if a person is not in compliance with their requirements, their period of registration is tolled, and that tolling is day for day. And that's a clarification rather than the language that currently appears in law that is a little confusing as it talks about each year. So we just want to make it clear that the tolling is day for day. Section 9 is the definition of sex offense. And in essence, if a crime appears in this definition, it is a crime that would require registration as a sex offender if the person is convicted of that crime. The first change here is on page 8. Line 21, and we're once again incorporating the new harassment statute into this list, and the person would be required to register after the second conviction. The other changes occur on page 9, and they incorporate the sending an explicit image of a minor, as Mr. Skidmore identified, and then also a couple of other offenses involving corpses and animal cruelty. Section 10 is the teaching certificates, and you can see there the substantive change is on page 9, line 30, incorporating the possession or distribution of child pornography as a reason for a lifetime revocation of a person's teaching certificates. Section 11 is the definition of domestic violence. And once again, on line 14, page 10, line 14, we are once again making a conforming change to the new harassment statute. We are also adding a couple of additional offenses into the definition of domestic violence, and that would be interfering with the report of a crime of involving domestic violence and unlawful contact. So both of those would be incorporated into the definition of a crime involving domestic violence. So if those crimes were committed against a household member, they would qualify as domestic violence. Section 12 is the section that allows a probation officer to arrest a probationer for a violation by a sex offender of a condition of probation. Section 13 is the section that expands the arrest authority of pretrial services officers to include escape in the third degree, tampering with evidence, and unlawful contact. Section 14 talks about the multidisciplinary child protection team, and this section allows that team to address situations where there is sexual contact between two children under the age of 13. Section 15 amends the mandatory reporter statute, and once again on page 12, line 20, we are once again incorporating the new harassment statute, so that's again a conforming change. Section 16 is an amendment to the applicability section of House Bill 49 that was passed in 2019. In that bill, there was a provision that required people who are required to register as sex offenders in another state, so if they're from Oregon, for example, and they're required to register there, that they would also be required to register when they come to Alaska. The amendment in this section is making that provision, those provisions retroactive, which means that people who are already here but were required to register in another state would also have to register in Alaska. Section 17 is the repealer section, and we're just repealing the section of law that talks about contact with the genitals, buttocks, or female breast with the intent to harass or annoy. So we're repealing that section as we've refined that statute into the new harassment statute. Section 18 is the applicability sections. The majority of the bill is prospective. There are two areas that are retroactive. Those areas would be the information that sex offenders and child kidnappers have to provide to the Department of Public Safety. That's retroactive, so it would capture people who are already required to register as sex offenders. They would be required to then give passport information, travel itineraries, that kind of thing. The other retroactive section is the section on teaching certificates. So if somebody has a teaching certificate in Alaska and they had been previously convicted of possession or distribution of child pornography, that would be a mandatory revocation. And then section 19 is the applicability section, and the bill is effective July 1, 2022.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, for walking us through the sectional analysis. Are there any questions from the committee at this time? Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I have multiple questions, and I don't know how many times this is going to be up, so if you want to, have me hold some of them, that's fine.
We do have some time today and to explore some of these questions.
Okay, great. First of all, I'll do a couple easy ones first. Section 7, is there a penalty if the sex offender does not do the notification as being required here?
This is John Skidmore for the record. The answer to your question is yes. When a offender refuses to comply with the registration appropriately, then they have failed to register as they are required under law, and there are penalties for them.
Okay, thank you. May I continue?
Well, are there going to be any other questions? I'll give you some latitude, like maybe knock off two or three, and then we'll go to somebody else on the committee and come back just to give everybody a fair shot.
And Section 8, Casey, could you remind us about what the tolling, how that works, and it's for good conduct and things like that? Just remind us, because Section 8 refers to that, so I'm trying to wrap my brain around what that
through the chair
the explanation means there.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'll try to do that. essentially what it means is if the person is not in compliance with their requirements to register as a sex offender, the clock stops. And so their period of registration will stop. So if they have to register for 15 years and on year five, they are out of compliance for some reason, the clock is going to stop and it's going to be tolled for until they get back into compliance. And if you see the language that's deleted there, it's a little confusing about how that tolling is supposed to take place. And we mean for it to be day for day. So for every day you're out of compliance, then that's another day that's going to be tacked on to the end of your registration.
And one more?
Sure. Section 9, it has to do with sending and then posting an image on the internet. So there are other ways that things get out to the public. And, something could be posted on a bulletin board in printed out, put it in a bathroom. It could be mass emailed. It could be mass text. So we're only talking about one display here on the internet. Have you considered or would you be open to something that would be public display language rather than just internet?
This is John Skidmore for the record. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the answer to your question is that particular statute, 1161.116, criminalizes when it's an electronic photo that's taken and displayed, and it is a Class B misdemeanor when it is simply shared with someone else. So, for instance, if you were to email it to somebody else, that would be that B misdemeanor. What we're talking about in the bill is only when you're required to register as a sex offender, and that's for the subsection that makes it an A misdemeanor, and that's when it's posted on a website specifically. So to the extent that you're saying, would we be open to other concepts? Absolutely, we would. That's just the way that the statute's laid out currently for those two different types of conduct.
Okay, thank you, and I'll save my others.
Yeah, we'll kind of round robin. I just have a quick question. Where was section 12? So it talks about adding a new subsection about a probation officer and
yes.
The power to arrest. Do they currently have the power to arrest, or is this a new power for them?
To the chair, there is some power for certain DOC employees to file charges. They always have the power to arrest. What this is really doing is not giving them the power to arrest, but to actually file a criminal charge. They have the power to arrest right now for a violation of probation. What this would say is that they also are given the power to file a document in court charging somebody with a new crime that's then referred to the prosecutor's office for prosecution.
Senator Q?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, Ms. Shorter, for being here. I guess a question, since we started the registry information, and now I've lost it, Section 7, I think. Can you explain the interaction between and among other states' registries, federal registry you mentioned in Alaska's? Do they not share information between and among when there's a prosecution, when someone needs to be investigated?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I can tell you when we prosecute those cases. I do know that there is some information that is shared. I believe Lisa Purrington from the Department of Public Safety is actually online, who handles the registry and might have more information about the type of information that's shared or under what circumstances. I can answer questions for you about when we would prosecute, but that specific sharing I would actually direct you to Ms. Purrington with DPS.
Follow up on that. Thank you. I guess the question goes to, is the intent here that an offender would, or someone subject to the registry would be able to file just with Alaska, and that would take care of their federal registration? We would share that information, or is the intent to make them file all the same information twice?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I appreciate that clarification. They do not have to register on the federal registry and the Alaska registry. The federal registry is for when somebody has committed a federal crime that requires registry. The state registry is when you've committed a state crime that requires registry. The significance of bringing us into compliance with the way the feds do their registry is they also set out guidelines of what they want others, what they want everybody else to do. And then, as the feds often do, they attach purse strings to those requirements. So, for example, in the state of Alaska, we'll receive certain federal dollars, but because we're not in 100% compliance with what they want us to do, that means we receive a slightly less amount in certain federal grants. This is an effort to try and get us further in compliance to be able to receive those dollars. That's first. Second, we would want to have that information because, for example, when you're traveling, if the person was intending to travel, say, from Alaska down to Seattle for some period of time, that would allow us to share that additional information that we've now been able to gather from them about their travel plans with the folks in Seattle, and therefore the folks in Seattle or the state of Washington would be able to monitor that offender when they come down to that location. And the hope is there's less likelihood that then they end up committing a crime against a victim in their state.
And I guess just the, one more on this, and then we can move to another topic. Is it our expectation that folks who are off the paper, right, they're not probationers, they're not parolees, they've served their sentence and they're done, but they're still on the registry. Is it our expectation that other states monitor them every time they step foot in those other states?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it would be my expectation that each state can decide for themselves what efforts they want to take in that sort of monitoring. Certainly when we're notified of folks that come to Alaska, then we do try and make sure that wherever that person's located, they don't end up staying, for example, in an apartment that's right next to a school. But the determination of how much somebody is monitored, that's a state-by-state policy call that I think each state gets to make of what sort of resources do they want to put into how they address the information they're provided from other states.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question somewhat along the same lines with the sex offender registry. We're significantly increasing the amount of information that we're asking them to turn over when they register. I'm aware, I believe, of at least one case that somebody used the sex offender registry to target former sex offenders. I'm wanting to say it was up in the Palmer area a few years ago. And then we're putting in all this other information, and I get worried about identity theft. Let's face it, we've had a few breaches in the state over the last couple of years. Is requiring them to turn over all of that information, does that open us up to liability in either case, either in terms of identity theft or in terms of attacks?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the important thing to understand is the information that an offender is required to provide to the Department of Public Safety does not equate with the information that's made available to the public. In other words, for example, we're requiring them to provide us with a Social Security number. That would never be posted online for other members of the public to have access to. That information is information that law enforcement keeps for themselves, for their own records, for investigations that they are involved in, or to help them monitor, if you will, what that person's up to, but that's not shared with the general public. To the second part of your question about are we concerned about identity theft, we're always concerned about identity theft. Having this additional information would not, in my mind, subject us to additional civil liability. It is protected in our criminal justice databases that have greater protections than most other databases that we have throughout the state system. Doesn't mean that it's foolproof, doesn't mean somebody couldn't get in there, but the CJIS compliance that we have to do, and forgive me, CJIS is Criminal Justice Information System. That's an acronym that the FBI puts out about the information that is housed and what has to be done to protect the information. That's that criminal justice information. There are additional hoops and steps that we have to take to protect it at all times, regardless of whether it's this registry or not.
All right, back to Senator Hughes.
Thank you. One of the things, just a request to the chair and to those presenting, we have been hearing for a number of years that we have either, I believe, the worst sexual crime rates, sexual assault problem in the nation. And so we've got a series of three bills. This is one of them. And at some point, it would be great to have, even if it's very brief, an overview of the problem that we're trying to address. We know we can't fix everything just by changing laws, but we are trying to make this a safer state. And I know there's been surveys conducted as well as how many people have been impacted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and one of the things is not always we think of women being the victims, but men are victims as well. So I'm just hoping maybe at some point we could maybe have a brief overview of that, Mr. Chair, so we understand the problem that these bills we're working to address. I think it's important. My question may open a can of worms, but for sexual assault involving penetration, is it necessary to prove force or threat of force?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the answer is yes.
Okay, so you gave the example of someone being in shock and freezing up. And so, you know, there are people where what starts out maybe as the harassment type thing progresses. And so now in the less egregious situation, not that it's a good thing, but it's not as bad as a full-blown act, we have a higher bar, and yet you could have that person in shock and frozen up and no force at all, and yet they're clearly being sexual assaulted to a worse degree. So how do you deal with that? Because we're not requiring that proof for something less egregious.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, you are correct that you can have conduct that starts off as what the law refers to as sexual contact that can then progress to sexual penetration. And whether it's contact or penetration, our sexual assault laws do require that force. That's what the Dorsey case stands for. And what I would tell you is that the harassment that is found in this particular bill, SB 187, can address both of those conducts. In other words, if you have penetration, you clearly have contact. It's just a further progression in the type of act that occurs. So this is a step in that right direction. Does this solve providing a new crime or a greater penalty for the penetration itself? I would tell you that's not something that SB 187 addresses in terms of a higher crime or a higher penalty. But that conduct, which is not currently criminalized, would be criminalized in the bill with this new harassment. And then at that point, it becomes a matter for arguing at sentencing about the type of sanction that should be imposed for that more egregious conduct, as you describe it.
Follow-up. I don't know if we can solve this, because I know it's an ongoing thing and something we talked about even a couple of years ago when we were working on other criminal statutes. And I understand it could be misused, and even it started out as the harassment, progressed to penetration, started out as contact, progressed to penetration, you could apply the contact law, but the penalty for that is, you know, so much more minor.
Yes.
It just seems like somehow we need a linkage so that in those kind of situations, that person is receiving a more severe penalty without having to prove force or threat of force for the penetration piece. Have you grappled with that, and do you have any ideas of how we could do that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is an issue that we've been looking at internally within the department and the administration. There are different thoughts about how to proceed, and I don't know that there's been a decision or a conclusion about which is necessarily the right way to attack it. But I absolutely understand what you're describing, and yes, I would agree with you that it is an issue that needs some attention.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And it's clear that the administration hasn't taken a position on how to address that. Would you be able to provide with us the different options so that, you know, as the lawmaking body, we could consider whether we might want to address that? I'm sure you've looked at what other states have done and how it's being dealt with, but could you provide various options for things that we could do to address the situation I described?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I could certainly try and provide you some examples of those things. I don't know that I can do it off the cuff today. I would want to make sure that I'm giving you a thoughtful look at what the options are, but yes, that can be done.
And a question that came up for me in this conversation about force or threat of force, is there statutory rape in Alaska law where it protects even consensual sex with a minor? Because there's no, may not be a force or threat of force, but.
Yes. To the chair, the answer is it's called sexual abuse of a minor in the state of Alaska, and there are four different degrees of it. that deal with the sexual contact or sexual penetration. Those are the two terms we use in the law, both contact and penetration, when it is of someone of a young enough age with someone at a higher age. There has to be a certain age difference between the two. But when that occurs, then yes, that is the crime that's otherwise in some states referred to as statutory rape. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the questions about consent and force are important, especially for the most severe assaults, as Senator Hughes was discussing. I want to come back just a little bit more to the text of the bill and this new felony of harassment. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a little bit concerned about the drafting and whether it really meets the intent in all cases. Certainly, Mr. Chairman, the descriptions that Mr. Skidmore gave of the unwelcome contact with the genitals are, let me just say, right, we're talking only about bad behavior here. So as I discussed degree, I don't want to give anybody the impression that I'm talking about things that should be ignored. But the things that were described in the initial presentation are much more severe than I think what the bill discusses. I just, looking at it, I mean, an unwelcome hug between two adults, inappropriate, offensive contact, but it is chest to chest contact. Is it the intention that that would be a sex felony?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. First, I would say it's not a sex felony for a couple of reasons. First, if anything is prosecuted under this harassment in the first degree, it's not a sex crime for the enhanced penalties that sex crimes receive. In other words, this would be a Class C felony that's 0 to 2, but a sex felony would have been 2 to 12 years for a first offense.
So a registrable sex offense the second time.
And so the registrable sex offense, what we're talking about there, the reason that I would take the hypothetical that you provide of an unwelcomed hug, the things that I think protect against that in the bill is, first, you have to look at the mens rea or the mental element. So it has to be intentional. You would have to intentionally engage in this conduct when you are reckless as to the fact that the other person does not want that conduct. If you're not reckless to that fact, then there is no crime that's been committed there. And the first offense is not registrable. It's only when you commit that second offense that it becomes registrable, because now there's become this pattern of behavior. So that was one of the things that the administration looked at in saying the first offense shouldn't be registrable, but by the time you get to the second one, it should be, for the type of scenario that you're describing, not in the sense that we would want to prosecute somebody for an unwanted hug, but to the extent that you have that first instance where someone has engaged in intentional conduct, the conscious objective to engage in this offensive behavior by touching one of three areas of the human body, that's not, well, it's a crime, that's not going to be registrable. But when you engage in that conscious objective to touch one of those three areas of the human body when it's offensive to that person, and you're doing it for the second time, then you've started to display a pattern of behavior of ignoring what your fellow human has indicated or which you know is offensive to them, and yet you continue to do it. And that's where the registration then becomes required.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, again, there are we're only talking about bad behavior, but I'm not sure that addresses the question of degree. Rather than dig deep into that right now, since we're doing initial questions, Mr. Skidmore focused on the specificity of three areas of the body. And I guess I wanted to ask why we're not addressing other sexualized touching that is, frankly, very violative, right? Mm-hmm. The description, I had a constituent call me up concerned about this bill and the concern was, what about the employer who touches your inner thigh, right, in an unwelcome way, right? This is clearly harassing behavior, but doesn't make contact with the genitals.
Mm-hmm.
What about unwelcome kissing or, licking was the other description. Doesn't make contact with these three areas of the body. We have just exactly, Mr. Chairman, what the presenter described in terms of violative and unwelcome behavior, but not covered? Why is that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, there's sort of two responses to that. The first is what we did is we took what was already found in statute, what the legislature had already grouped together, touching one of those three areas of the body, and we followed that same pattern that was set up. We hadn't expanded it beyond that. When you talk about touching of the inner thigh, kissing, licking, something of that nature, I agree with you that those things can be offensive. Those things can still be prosecuted as a harassment. In fact, one of the changes we made in Section 3 that Ms. Schroeder talked about, when you look at line 20, knowingly subjects another person to offensive physical contact, those are criminal conduct. It's just not at the higher level of touching one of those three areas that we described, the genitals, the buttocks, or the female breast. It's still a crime. It's just a lower level crime. That's first. The second thing that I would say is that frequently, and you gave the example of employment, there are other laws. They're not criminal laws, but there are other laws that say that certain type of conduct or physical contact with employees is not allowed in the workplace. Now, we don't criminalize it. We don't say you're going to go to jail for that. But there are certainly substantial penalties that can be imposed against somebody in the civil context for a hostile work environment or a sexual harassment in that work environment, where there are substantial financial penalties as well as injunctive relief that can be applied. But it's not part of the criminal law beyond what I described as that harassment, where if it was knowingly subjects another person to offensive physical contact, we could prosecute at that lower level. It's just not at the higher level for those three areas of the body.
Mr. Chairman, we can get deeper into this, but I'm less interested in writing our criminal laws with regard to what could happen in the workplace and ignoring what could happen at the movie theater or on the bus. Or thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Can you speak a little bit about the difference between maybe the municipal crime of harassment, maybe like in Anchorage, the municipal crime of harassment versus the proposed state crime of harassment?
Yes. I want to organize my thoughts there for a moment, Chair. The answer to your question is that there was a number of years ago, and I'm failing to recall the exact number. I want to say it was about six. But there was a number of years ago that, for instance, the municipality in Anchorage aligned their municipal code with the state code, so that if it was a crime under state code, the municipal code would reflect that and it would be easier for them to handle the misdemeanors. What I can tell you is that municipal codes, whether Anchorage or Juneau or some other municipality that wanted to have a municipal code, they can criminalize misdemeanor conduct. They don't criminalize felony level conduct. And so this harassment crime that's proposed in this bill, because it would be a felony, isn't something that the municipalities would be able to address. Could I tell you today what the Anchorage Municipal Code says about harassment? Not without looking it up, sir.
Yeah, I kind of realize it's not your job.
It's not a code that I deal with regularly. I am capable of looking it up for you, but I just don't know it off the top of my head, sir.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I think this is dipping our toe in what we'll be doing for much of the next few weeks on this and the other two bills. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, for presenting Senate Bill 187 to us today. At this time, we'll set Senate Bill 187 aside. And I will ask, is there any other business before the committee? Seeing no other business before the committee, our next meeting will be Friday, February 25th at 1:30 p.m. And today we are adjourned a little early at 2:48 p.m.